Word to the Wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes, as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. That, my dear friends, would be Through Straight Edge on day two of Joe Abercrombie's The Heroes.
Hey there, this is Cross.
I am PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
And I kind of dropped a timetable bomb on Crossland right before we started recording, so we just jumped right into this.
I personally get the sense that we're just going to have to split this episode in two. I don't know how else we'll do it, but we'll figure
we'll
it out.
We'll see. We've done faster episodes than that.
This is not a fast episode, though. Anyway, it's fine. But today is our fifth episode talking about The Heroes by Joe Abercrombie. This week we're reading, Day Two, Dawn Through Straight Edge. Before we get into kind of the meat of things, PJ, quick overview.
Lightning fast overview is that fighting has started to happen, including ridiculous explosions, and people took credit for deaths that weren't theirs to claim.
This is true.
A lot more than that happened. Finry became a proper soldier.
True. Killed more people than Beck did. Actually killed the same number of people as Beck did.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Although at least she was killing people on the opposite side.
And our boy Craw got a promotion.
He did. And Weirin invented a sandwich, very importantly.
Which clearly the highlight of the entire episode. And I think we'll spend a good 45 minutes talking about that.
45 minutes of our approximate hour 20 minutes, hour 15 minutes that we have available. Yeah, for sure. Overall thoughts? How'd you feel?
Overall thoughts? It felt kind of like a return to Before They Are Hanged in a weird way. I don't know why. Maybe it felt like the Gurkish, like Degaska a little bit.
That's fair.
Just vibes. It's just the vibes. It made me think of Degaska, I think.
I think I get some of that through the, what are the other parts of that perspective that I'm thinking of? Whomst am I thinking of? This is not great for the speediness.
I guess Calder a little bit, especially towards the end.
Oh! I'm comparing to West mentally in my head. That's what I was thinking. I was like, okay. I was looking for West as a comparison, especially through like the chain of command chapter. That feels very like Westy in a lot of ways, be it like Croy's despondence or like Felnig's or Valamir's, you know, kind of like that whole handoff chain. Mm-hmm. Or rather not Valamir's, but we're letterlinging. But yeah.
Yeah.
Beyond kind of your comparisons.
Also, weird thing that just popped into my head. I feel like I'm becoming more and more reluctant to use the phrase our boy. And I think it's because we're so far into the series as a whole that this feels like we've been through so little time that it's undeserved to be our boy. But like,
oh, fair.
It's still a good chunk of the way through this book. So I should be more liberal with my our boys and our girls and our people.
Yeah, this is
the resolution
roughly
I've come to just now.
after the end of this, I think we're roughly at the halfway point. Like this is very close to 287 out of 549. So like basically right there. It's a little bit over even, but plenty of story to go yet, of course. Yeah. But it is interesting. Also because this book is juggling so many more points of view in general than most of the other books are.
We added another four today.
Yeah, right. I still feel like internally very jokey, haha, bad about like there's no more point of views, PJ, because I also don't want to spoil the existence of more chapters like that, you know, like casualties. So
I don't, I mean, yes, they are technically points of views. I don't think they have the same weight.
They're not primary points of view.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they count in the same way.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, let's get into it. Day two starts, of course, with our little quote here. You can't say that civilization don't advance. However, for in every war, they kill you in a new way, which is Will Rogers. I think this is the first American quote among any of the books. That's not entirely true.
His name, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. You're so close with Steve Rogers.
It's Steve,
but no. yeah, yeah, yeah. No, Will Rogers was an American humorist and lived through a good chunk of different war times. A big, well-celebrated writer. So for the period of time, I believe he was active from active from the 1860s to 1930s, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
I mean, you're not wrong. That's an android way of, what have you done with my friend?
It's generally not the way that you would frame it. No, but there are like active years of thought and then like active years of duty. And I was like, my brain just squeezed all that together for like, he was active. His flip switch was on.
I, for one, am excited for my living but inactive years. Like, that sounds like a lot of fun.
True.
But as far as this quote goes, we get a very, very similar, if not almost the same quote from Baez later on, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this the first time that a quote that's like been as a chapter heading has been like parroted within the text itself? I think so.
Not exactly. There were a couple of other ones, but this is maybe... Oh, sorry. This I'm thinking like chapter direct. Titles. This is definitely...
Chapter titles is one thing. But yes. I mean, like, this is philosophical or poetic quotes that we've had throughout this whole story.
Yeah, I think so. I would go so far as to say yes. Yeah. Yeah. I would generally agree with that. It's interesting to, you know, we also get like the battle map update. We get some like physical stuff there. I don't know if you saw that and like looked at it, but it's kind of a great visualization.
I read on my Kindle, but I didn't read like the whole section. I picked up a couple chapters in. Otherwise, sure. I listened through like three times.
Got it.
But I missed the map. I'm sad about that.
Yeah, I listened through this one twice and then read through it once. And so it wasn't until I like picked it up again physically that I was like, oh yeah, they do the updates every day on the map. So you can get a sense of where everything actually is in addition to the descriptions. But all right. Well, getting into it here, the first chapter here is Dawn. We open up Dawn with Craw waking up to a discussion between Wonderful, Drawfed, Jolyon, and Wirin, wherein he presents his sliced bread cheese trap. And what a delightful idea this is, as the other two clearly show that they lack vision.
Not only do they lack vision, I think significantly less of them for not having this vision.
As they just eat their hunks of bread and hunks of cheese.
It's not the same. It's not. Mm-hmm. I know I don't have to defend the sandwich to you, Crossland, but it makes me mad. I'm saying, like, I've got the same thing. No, you fucking don't.
Mm-hmm. You could even add ham, sliced ham in the middle. And he's like, it's funny that it's cheese first, though.
I mean, we're run. I think that's probably more to do with the rations that they have available to them. It'd probably be significantly more difficult to have cured meat. Cured meats is one thing, but like.
Yeah, salted cured meats are not uncommon, but yeah, anyway.
But he's just got to toast it. He's almost already to sandwich perfection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love how later we know Father of Swords to cut it. He's holding it between his knees.
It's just like the giant sword as a fucking knife. Although that does raise the interesting point or like conversation piece of like, this probably is a maker's blade or something adjacent to one.
Yeah.
Because the edge is repeatedly called out as dull despite him sharpening it. And it does chop through people like nothing. And it also cuts the bread. So.
Yeah. I have tried many times to cut bread with knives, if you can believe it. I smush the bread. I smush the bread too much.
You always smush it.
I always smush the bread.
Smushing the bread. Yeah. Yeah. So they continue kind of this banter and conversation, you know, Craw's kind of coming to, they begin to get ready to get ready for the day's work and effort. And we find that Brack has died overnight in his sleep.
I can't help but think that Brack is this crew's Caspa.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that I genuinely didn't know who they were talking about.
Yeah.
Have they mentioned Brack before this?
Yeah, he was one of the archers. He was one of the good guys that like they sent out onto the hill. Like Brack went around and was like shooting the people. But
yeah, we didn't spend a whole lot of face time with him though.
No, yeah, and to be fair, I think that this, to me at the very least, before we get into the funeral rites that happen a little bit later, this shows sort of the like the nature, the blasé sort of effect of war, and like why Kraws like dozen has really never been the same group of people or men, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, this mythological militia.
Yeah. But back to the mud.
Back to the mud. We then move to Finry, still among Governor Meade's forces, as she wakes up next to Hal. Hal suggests that she stay with Croy, but further away from the battle, as she continues to advocate for him to push up his career and power, settling in with people who might help him climb. Like Brint, I believe she brings up as an example of someone that she should be cozying up to because of his, you know, adjacency to the king. They come to a point of conflict, and he apologizes and just asks her not to do anything rash. She, however, feels more in rush to change her circumstances than he is. Do you feel like she's right, you know, relating to his good nature, like where she stands? I don't know. How do you make?
I don't know if she's right, but she's not wrong either, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Like, I feel like she is very much ignoring, intentionally or not, how cautious Hal has to act, specifically because of his, like, family position.
Sure.
It's not lost on her, but the differences in steps that he's able to take or should take mm-hmm. are different than what she could do in his shoes, if that
sure.
makes sense. And I think there's like a little bit of lost in translation sort of something or other between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But also it's like just like the divide of ambition, right? Like
that's true too. I think that's definitely true too.
Go ahead.
At some point, or when she brings up Brint, he kind of rebuffs that more intensely than I would have expected, and I'm not quite sure why, if there's something that I'm missing or something that we haven't been exposed to as far as some sort of interaction between the two of them.
My perspective is that it was more like leaning into corruption as opposed to like his good honor, like not strictly, okay. like not that cleanly, if that makes sense, as far as I just said it, you know, but
yeah.
It feels similar or adjacent to that idea. I do want to say that I think that it's important to note, too, that, like, as we know from reading the rest of the series, in the Union, at the very least, most women are sort of held in station to some degree. You know, we're talking medieval Europe. There isn't, like, a wider position. They are sort of, like, homesteady-ish or adjacent or more like trophies than, you know, like, people sometimes are in a lot of considerations. Not everyone right. treats people this way, but generally speaking, that seems to be the vibe. And Hal doesn't treat her that way either, but he's not like adjusted to the norm either of someone like pushing and advancing for the pair of them. So there's some interesting like gender expectations there that the series yeah. is exploring too.
Mm-hmm. But I think even removing that from the equation, there's still a difference in ambition between the two of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, right. Some of that comes from the fact of the life that she's lived as a general's daughter, you know? Like,
yeah.
We then hop over to another of our Union characters, Corporal Tunney, of whom we find out is a particularly strong sleeper, wakes from his sleep to two of his recruits trying to light a fire in the swamp and advises against it, much to their stomach's protestations. There's a discussion as to the location of Letterlingen and whether or not he is returning, to which Tunney makes a joke that he says his name wrong because it makes him laugh. But they also resolve that they are to do nothing until they're told what to do next.
To be perfectly fair, I also find it funny when Tunney says his name. But I do love that the response to no fire is, but how cook bacon? Like,
what do we eat? How cook bacon? What do we eat?
Yeah. Or like, oh, so I should eat this raw then, instead of the right assumption.
You probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Don't eat, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, different food, man. That's maybe a little more harsh than it should be, I think, because these are completely inexperienced, barely soldiers. So they're inexperienced recruits. And I mean, it's a great lesson for them to learn that, mm-hmm. hey, in a situation like this, fire is a beacon to the enemy. And it sucks that you have to go hungry, but that's the situation we're in. So mm-hmm. Despite him grumbling about these idiots, like it's a good lesson for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's not too harsh, but he is his usual sort of standoffish harsh.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. So that's the first dose of Tunney that we get for the week as they continue to kind of, you know, tough it, rough it in the swamp. We then cut over to Calder's dream, and man, is this one fucked up. This one sits with me as Forley the Weakest makes an appearance alongside Bad Enough, of whom Dogman killed many novels ago. We draw the connection. Calder is the man responsible for his death one way or another, for the death of one of our named men from our original series, from the original group. And it's sad. He was just trying to do some good. Remember, they were just trying to kind of make a sort of like peace deal as opposed to approaching it with any sort of violence in mind. And instead they got a body and a head and a bag returned to them in a cart. Yeah. And I think what's important here and interesting from Joe's perspective as a writer and from the characters is it haunts Calder, which in this context layers in a lot of complexity onto the story through his lens that the story begs, you know, is he really a bad guy? Who really is the bad guy here?
Yeah. Yeah. I was simultaneously so excited and so sad.
Yeah.
To see Forley mentioned again and to get a little bit more light on, I mean, it's not a ton, but it is a little bit of light on what happened to him between when we saw him run off and when we mm-hmm. saw him get carted back. I think it makes a great frame for which I'm now viewing Calder. And to your point, it really does make the who's good and who's bad line a whole lot more blurry.
How do you feel? Does this change, you know, your feelings about Calder? Did it alter them in any way within the story?
I've always kind of, I mean, I maybe it's just the say or for the fact that he is a primary and very intimate perspective that we've inhabited, that I didn't see him as like a super bad dude in general. So I don't think this, I think this bolstered that view. Or gave some actual solid evidence to it, just like beyond just the perspective lens.
Yeah, cool. All right. I agree with that. I can see that here within that scope. Okay. Fair. We again have Scale and Calder confronting each other on their beliefs and ideas surrounding their father. Just to kind of quote Scale here, I think that he does a really good job kind of layering this in. And we talked about this a little bit last week too, but men listened because they knew he had iron in him. Do you know what I remember him telling me? Get what you can with words, because words are free. But the words of an armed man ring that much sweeter. So when you talk, bring your sword.
Mixed metaphors aside, it's good advice.
I don't know that it's a really mixed metaphor. How is it
that much sweeter versus words are free? Like there's like, it's not really a mixed metaphor, but it's like there's a few different sort of dangling halves of different what could be metaphors.
It
doesn't feel like a cohesive.
Fair.
I think what I took from this is that Scale got the point, but I bet Bethod said it a little bit more poetically.
I think this actually is fairly poetic. And the reason I say that is because so when you talk, bring your sword implies that no matter what, you need to also have a sword at your side, even when you're coming with words,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he lost any of the, I don't know, maybe.
Sure.
The ring.
It just like, shook weirdly.
Ring that much sweeter really didn't resonate in my head for whatever reason. But I think that this shows, we've seen Bethod's sort of influence imparted on Calder quite a bit, and we knew sort of the brutality of Scale, but I think this really proves that the two of them are together, like they are two halves of the whole that is Bethod.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, it is. They are a necessary pair, you know, in a lot of ways to like get off the entirety of Bethod's ideals. It's an interesting thing to have like one character split into two in some ways. So
I think
even though we didn't really know Bethod that well, you know,
no, we really didn't.
Yeah.
But obligatorily we have to bring up when there is a good performance by Stephen Pacey and him saying iron in him was rattling.
Yeah. The way he kind of like shouted at it and like gripped and like got into his throat. It really sounded like Scale got in Calder's face, you know, and then backed off. And same with not to the same degree, but the, like, the curtness on, like, so when you talk, bring your sword. Like, there's just that, like, clip to it that's, that's great. Really makes it punch. All that said, though, Calder is then left to Khalil's wall to attend and defend one edge of the old bridge as he heads towards Scarling's Finger, and he's to contact Broad 10 Ways to help Scale if things go south.
There's a weird ping of expectation in me every time they bring up Clail's wall, Because they've mentioned Clail offhandedly as some old farmer, just some nobody that built a wall. And I'm really, like, the more they mention the wall and the name of the wall, I'm really expecting something to come up down the line about Clail. I don't know what it would be. I don't think it would matter that much. And maybe it's fine that it's just something lost to history. But like the rest of the heroes, nobody really knows what they are. There's just kind of myth around it. But this is not really myth around it either. It's just there. Some old farmer named Clail built a wall. But I'm anticipating something, and I'm not sure what.
It's been mentioned twice. To me, I'm not certain if it's if I derive anticipation from it in the same way of like a Chekhov's gun, right? But I can understand, you know, like that pulling. To me, it feels more like a landmark to ground you, you know, without a map to some degree, right?
That's fair, too.
Because you get an idea of, like, at the end of the bridge is the wall, and the other side of the bridge is the heroes. To the left of the heroes is Scarling's finger. And so we can kind of, like, picture those things in a line. On one side is Osrong, on the other side, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it kind of gives a sense of space. That said, I can totally get it, though. It does share that same sort of, like, mythological question as the heroes, but with a more recent bend of, like, well, could Clail be like a real dude? I mean, he probably was, but like, is he still?
Yeah. Maybe he's there.
Maybe he's a ghost.
I mean, maybe he's fighting.
Oh, yeah. Could legit be here. Although, why does he just have a wall and not like a house? Like, why did he make a wall?
Yeah. Don't ask Clail questions.
It's true. Clail can't answer them anyway. But yeah, so it leaves us an interesting point that ultimately kind of resolves in part of Chains of Command as a portion of that. So it's a nice kind of like call and response between these chapters. And even better is our next chapter, opening remarks and closing remarks, as they kind of turn up the heat and then turn down the heat respectively. But
that's a good point.
Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, we end our chapter with men standing over the graves of those who had died between last night's rest and recreation and this morning. Kral reflects on what makes a hero. And I think I've said this many times, and I'll say it again probably. This book feels a little bit more like Joe has a thesis of what he's trying to get across here. And this is one of several, right, that he's kind of like really trying to impart pretty directly, I think.
Yeah.
Mentioned this.
One of several for sure, but also the most ever present of them, including the inside cover of the book or the back of the book, whatever it is. Like, the description of the book, the title of the book as well. Like, yeah, what's a hero? Are there any?
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any? Do they exist? Why do they? What? Why don't they? It's interesting. And I really love it. I think that this book does get philosophical in a very interesting way about soldiering and soldiery, which is not something that I think that we've explored over the course of any of the books that we've read. So it makes for a very kind of different read that way. But anyway, the quote itself, what makes a man a hero? Big deeds, big name, tall glory, and tall songs? No. Standing by your crew, I reckon. Never enough for Brack to eat. He died peaceful. Reckon he'd have liked that, even if he loved a good fight. Dying in your sleep is long stretch better than dying with steel in your guts, whatever the songs say. Fuck the songs, you know, as they all kind of refrain. Yeah.
It's good to finally get it, like, an actually good speech from Kraw. And this isn't one that he is dreading having to give a speech a little bit, but it's more out of like, I don't want to have to keep giving these speeches, and not so much, I have this obligation, I really don't want to fulfill it. Like, he kind of had that vibe with the brothers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we kind of saw that, but he keeps getting like pulled away and like doesn't linger on it. This like he kind of stepped into the role of leader, eulogizer, as it were, and I think he did it really, really well, exceptionally.
Yeah, he tried to knock it out as well as he could, and he's doing a good job with what he has, you know, and what he has to put up with. And I think that kind of like even harkens back to the beginning of us talking about this chapter, where it's like, it makes us question like the number of times that he's had to do this for the dozen. There's never been a solid dozen realistically. You know, it seems like he's just kind of maybe churning through people variously, because that's sort of the state of crews in the north and of the wars and uncertainty of the time. Those are the times, you know?
Yeah.
And
them's the times.
What a brutal refrain. All right, cool. With that, we move into opening remarks. We then turn to Beck, receiving a boot from Ref to wake him up with the Union coming and the lingering shadow of Shivers imprinted on his mind. The young soldiers look out the windows, donning their slings and arrows, literally, and begin to wait for them to eventually come. Flood advises that there are two houses that they need to hold and that that'll be what they and his small squad and coterie of men will do over the course of the morning.
I think, I don't know what it is, but I want to bring up the point that Reft seems to have softened, changed since we met him. And I think that's probably a function of these two kids getting to know each other more and like traveling with each other and like becoming friends, or at least not being so bristly towards each other. I don't know. We talked a little bit about him seeming more experienced, and I think that's true, but I really would be interested in getting into his head. I know we won't, obviously, but
yeah,
he seems like an interesting, like he seems more interesting as a character now, briefly, fleetingly, than he did when he was just kind of the foil to Beck at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, it is a tragedy that he does get pretty interesting, I would say. And even most of the boys that are around him, I would say, get like pretty interesting and more directly involved. But also, that's the nature of the beast, right? Like, this is in some ways like a Saving Private Ryan. These people are here to die and to fight for land that they may or may not matter to them in the long run,
right,
for someone else's flag. So, yeah. Woof. So, all that said, they're given their orders to hold the house, as that is Flood's order. He advises to not get lost when the blood gets hot. By Flood, this is a great piece of advice that I found really interesting, because we see this happen to our characters often in combat. It even happens to Finry, you know, as we kind of jump into her stabbing someone from like a cold moment to a hot moment. The boys rally around, their weapons ready, and there's an exchange between Reft and Beck. Again, another interesting one. Thought you'd be happy. Looks like you'll be getting a chance to be a hero. I am happy, snapped Beck. And not shitting himself at all. Just
certainly
funny considering he pisses himself later.
No poopies. Not at all.
No poopies. Just pissies.
Beck is really kind of a shit through this whole chapter. There's the other boy too. Like Beck had, like,
daughter.
They're talking about arrows and bows. He's like, I've got a sling. Like,
be any good?
Not any fucking use in a window anyway. Mm-hmm. And he's not good at it. So like, yeah, he's trying to be helpful, man. Like this is a situation where you have to chip in with everything you've got and get a little bit scrappy. And Beck is too inexperienced and too hot-headed to understand that.
Yeah, too much of an asshole in a lot of ways to understand any nuance around any of it.
But I do, to your point earlier, appreciate how much blood temperature is. Comes into play lots through Beck and lots through Finry and Gorst as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Craw?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
I don't know. Maybe when the hot blood lands in his mouth from Splitfoot's exploded head in the next chapter, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could be that. I don't know. Yeah. Cause he doesn't really get up to much specifically, but. So, before we get there, though, we move to Finry and Mead in their own residence in the High Hall. We get a note that the Dogman appears to have abandoned him, of which is definitely a misread, even based on Finry's own internal reaction, you know, not understanding. And we kind of see the kind of person that Mead is as he paints them as, you know, savages as well. Finry takes this opportunity to make a suggestion, and Mead shuts it down very thoroughly and like very politically in an interesting way by pointing out that he's of a will to thwart the closed council's attempt to put his brother in the governorship over him. And, you know, that's pretty crazy, and that her petty plans are really nothing in compared to what the power that he wields. This leaves Finry with Elise pouting in a corner and taking out her own pitiful failings on the undeserving woman. I just kind of feel bad for Elise throughout most of this.
Yeah, Elise really does get the final short end of everything.
Yeah.
But that swift turn from Mead into this terrifying man of power, it was incredibly intimidating and really well, like you said, thorough in his ability to shut things down.
he like really put it to her in a very poignant and like powerful way.
And saw exactly, like, he sees right through her. He sees exactly what she's doing.
Yeah. She thinks she's so clever, but the reality is that we're never as clever as we think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then
is it still this chapter where, or is it later on where she's like, I can still play the helpful woman to kind of turn him.
I think it's like, this
she
chapter.
Still schemes against him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's this chapter and then also the next time that she shows up. But yeah. From there, we end the chapter then with Beck seeing the beginning of the battle unfolding, thousands of Union men fighting, rooms filling up with smoke, and he runs cold as he sees the conflict come to him as arrows are drawn and they get ready, although they're not trying to give away their position yet.
Yeah. Fuck, man. It's just a claustrophobic situation. I found myself throughout this entire like section really kind of matching the scared energy of Beck through his chapters. Like I really got in tune with him quite a bit. I don't know what it was.
I'm with you. I think Beck is my personally out of the segments that we've read so far, in quotes, least favorite character or perspective to read to some degree, but simultaneously maybe the most emotive and emotional and relatable of the perspectives. There's the like brazen naivete, you know, of like capability. It's totally like Dunning-Kruger, you know, on display in its own way. And yeah, that's kind of, it's horrifying. It's, I keep bringing up like Saving Private Ryan as a reference. Abercrombie mentions a lot of different war movies that inspired this book. So it's not just one by any stretch of imagination, but I get a lot of that sort of like fear that you get out of the first 13 minutes of that movie in his perspective.
Yeah, I believe that. I can agree with that. Yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie.
Yeah, me too. It's been, we watched it in Maple Grove at one point. So it's been, you know, I don't know, that's what, 6 or almost 7 years? So it's been a bit. Mm-hmm. Time. All right, with that, we move into the Infernal Contraptions. We open with a letter from Gorst, classically to Zal, and calling all these different men heroes. He does also internally reflect, is this even worth it to be writing these letters? Is it going to arrive? And if so, does that even make an impact?
Patriotic platitudes. Or
yes.
Patriotic horseshit. He might have said both of those. I can't remember.
Yeah. I think he says those in sequence or very close, like patriotic platitudes and then patriotic horseshit.
Yeah. Yeah. I had this theory that things were getting more and more true to form in his letters. And this kind of took a step back towards just, as he says, platitudes to the king. He does mention that he's received letters back from Jizal in the past. He's complaining in that because it's been several weeks or several months or whatever it has been since he's gotten anything. But I am so curious what the content of the letters from Jizal to Gorst would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. I am also very interested. I've actually been taking note through this read of all of the letters that he sent so far. This is the 4th and a half letter that he's written. And it's only been technically 19 days in total, but he's written 2 letters in the last 2 days, 2 and a half even. So like, how would Jizal have had any time to respond to the previous letter? You know, you're effectively like live tweeting the battle and then it has to ride by horse back to the Union, which is going to take several days.
And takes a horse, it takes a horseman off the,
yeah.
Feels like they should have put all of their horses towards fighting. I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah. Commit the horses.
Right. It would be impossible to miss this like first page and not reference the absolutely insane internal dialogue that he has right off the bat. Run, practice, shit a turd, write a letter, eat, watch, shit a letter, eat, bed, pretend to sleep, but actually lie awake all night trying to wake, wank, up, run, letter. It's so good.
He does say write a turd also after shit a letter, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I must have skipped it. It's
all good.
It's within like, the same segment.
But this monotonous spiral, that's still comical. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. It's excellent. And just perfectly humorous. Again, Gorst, like, pulling us into the funny in a similar way to Glockta because of the internal monologue.
I wonder if he's been writing more letters that haven't shown up on page for us.
By the sounds of it, it sounds like he's writing two a day, given his own description, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. All told, though, the work to capture the bridge isn't going incredibly well under the leadership of Midorik. You know, it doesn't seem to be faring well. We learn later of some rafts. But beneath the bridge, even the battle goes worse as they fight really terribly. I mean, there's this, like, this depiction as Gorse reads it as like a hug, you know, like going down between two guys that stab each other really closely.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah. And among that, like, Baez walks up and has a folding chair placed for him, making his appearance alongside Sulfur on the battlefield.
Yeah, just total nonchalant, uncaring, basically acting like he's at the beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he may as well have like a little cocktail in his hand.
He's got to have sunglasses. His bald head is smeared with sunscreen.
It's the morning. You know what I mean?
Trunks. Like,
we're talking like the gray of the morning and the fighting is going on this way. But yeah, it's crazy with the drizzle and everything else. He's got a great quote as well that he says, and this is sort of a little bit of a paraphrase to reference back to the previous line, but without wars, societies are apt to become soft, flabby, like a man who eats only cake. He reached and punched Gorse playfully on the arm and then shook out his limp fingers in fake pain. Ouch, I bet you don't eat only cake, do you?
So would you say wars are the kale smoothies of society's diet?
I would say running in plate.
According to Baez.
Yeah, running in plate. But not full plate. Just most of the plate is the kale smoothie. Need more soldiers like Gorse, apparently. Except for not too many. We can't have too many Gorse.
I don't know if we could deal with more Gorse. Yeah. It's good to have one.
So we get to the sort of namesake of the chapter. These giant tubes of gray black metal in their cradles pointed directionally at the heroes. Well, he takes this in. Gorst compares the din of the noise to Cardati's house in many ways. And so they test the beasties as one blast, and the world is introduced to these infernal contraptions with an ear-splitting roar.
Gorst pretty quickly runs through that night at Cardati's, and I feel like at one point he kind of indicated that when everything went down, he was with a prostitute. Or did I make that up? Something about with her. And I don't have my book with me right now.
I don't remember. I'll look this up for the next episode. I feel like he says something to that effect. Like he was in a bedroom and then like pulling his pants up, barely got his pants up, ran out into the hall. It's something like that. And then he got like kicked down.
With some clarity, like with that as a little bit of clarity, I think it's really kind of bringing more explanation to his own guilt and his anger towards how that night unfolded and the results therein of his position.
Which is also in some ways like kind of earned, you know, in like a real way.
It makes it feel less like he's just the scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
Like it actually feels like a, like you said, earned demotion. Potentially. I'm not sure.
Before the closed council, as they stripped him of his position, the bottom dropping out of the world all over again, twisted up with Finry holding her, holding smoke, coughing smoke as he stumbled through. So it is a dream of her. For some reason, though, I feel I'm getting the distinct feeling that like I thought, and my thought is that he mentioned this before, not just in this reference. Yes, I think that's what I thought.
He imagines being with Finry anytime he was with a prostitute, maybe?
Almost certainly. Almost certainly. Yeah. So I'm with you there. I feel like it was in a previous chapter where he had mentioned that maybe like he wasn't fully, because I thought he like was buckling his pants up. But anyway, when he's reflecting on it with like shivers kicking him down very early in the novel.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll double check, though, for next week, for that sake.
We'll piece this. We're the words and whiskey investigators will piece together this mystery.
Normally, this is where I would take a second and search, but we don't have time.
That's okay.
It's totally fun. Yeah. So all told, they test these beasties as one blast and the world's introduced to these infernal contraptions with an ear-splitting roar.
Dude.
How do you feel about gunpowder and cannons?
I think more than anything, like it's super cool. Super cool to see these things come to life in a fantasy world. But I think the coolest part about it is what we haven't quite gotten to yet. It's directionally aimed at the heroes, but the potentially, I think it's an intentional jab at, I don't know if you can even call it a jab at it, whatever, a commentary on the industrialization of warfare, destroying the idea of heroism.
Mm, yes. Yeah, that as well. Right.
Yeah. Felt like a very strong commentary.
I would agree with you. And I think in addition, we kind of get into that as the cannons themselves fail at the very end of the chapter and Gorst goes off. Like, that feels like the moment at which it's like, now you're still going to need heroes, you know, mm-hmm. regardless of what you think. Heroes, in quotes.
Yep.
Which is an interesting, you know, no talking point. Yeah.
No heroics for Gorst. Yeah.
That's the rule. From that cannon launch, we then cut over to Craw standing next to Splitfoot and Near Dao up on the heroes. There's some debate and argument over Craw's connection to Calder and why he's sort of backing him as a part of the conversation ongoing, but not much can be made of it before Splitfoot's head disappears entirely as eardrums blow and unthinkable damage is wrought upon one of the heroes. Weirin tries to help him up as he sits gaping at the men destroyed, smashed, and twisted by the missile.
Yeah, Joe did a very good job of describing a missile strike up close by someone who had mm-hmm. never fathomed a missile or anything like it.
Mm-hmm. The possibility of a cannon, it's
fucking crazy. I know it's a short-lived sort of spat between Splitfoot and Craw, but I've just got to commend Craw on his ability to stand up for Calder when Calder isn't even there. Like, his mm-hmm. convictions are so strong and so just northernly pointed. I don't know how to describe it. He's
Craw's our boy. You know what I mean?
Craw's our boy.
I think.
I think
pretty
that's
solidly.
Where I'm going with that.
Yeah. He's got like the good sense about him. You know, like a lot of the other characters that we described throughout are heroic in some ways, but I feel like Craw really embodies like an ethical, moral hero in a way that a lot of the rest of our characters can skimp on or do skimp on intentionally
mm-hmm.
or advantage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. And yeah, like you said, the depiction of the missile blowing apart the guy's head, the Splitfoot's head,
woo,
you know, bits of flesh and bone clicking into him, some washing into his mouth, you know, like, yeah. Ugh. From there, we cut back to Gorst and Baez sitting there, and Sarrazin and his Adepti confirm the hit and cheer the shot, but Baez non-complacently urges them to continue with the siege, to fire them until they were fire no longer. Gorst's attention turns to the rafts on the river, which draws Baez's own bit of cheerful laughter as the air splits again, kind of mocking again, sort of exactly what you were saying before, mocking sort of like old warfare by and large.
Yeah. That this is where there's the weirder, more different boom. And what's his fucking name?
Calder?
No.
Sarrazin?
Our eater boy. Sulfur. Like, Gorst sees him, like, jabbing at something incredibly fast and then, like, has something the size of a dinner plate in his hand.
Yes. Hang on.
Was the more different boom the cannon failing, or was it this thing with Sulfur happening?
My understanding is that it was the cannon failing. I think that's actually the next time that we cut back.
Okay.
And he is effectively stopping what is coming for Baez. Like,
gotcha.
He's effectively defending. Because he comes out with like a hunk of metal. And I think he like catches it. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
If I remember.
That makes sense.
At first, in this reread through, I was like, does he have the divider for some reason? Like, why would he have the divider?
Yeah, that's kind of what piqued my interest too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a brief moment where I thought it was that, and it was like, no, he catches the metal.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I was just looking through, just making sure that none of that was wrong. Yeah. From there, though, we do turn to Calder, hearing the blasted things, but confused as to what's happening. We then see him kind of almost immediately reflect on one of these landing in the crop field behind him, as it sort of like blasts a big arc, and he's just like, whoa, what is this? But he's quickly interrupted as Pale as Snow and White Hansel have returned with news and good news as to the work that Scale is doing, holding the bridge seamlessly, no problems, doesn't need to call for additional assistance yet. All told, though, one of the balls nearly misses the group of them, and the sound of them, it explodes and crashes into Khalil's wall, sends Hansel's horse over, the men draw weapons seemingly at the sound, and this collision with the wall sends a bits of scree gear and men twisting into the air, in a way that Calder isn't used to and can't fathom.
Yeah.
He's like, oh,
I was supposed to be behind that wall.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. But this sudden revolution in warfare.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struck with this story, this series, and how they deal with the development of huge important in engineering as very quick, very sudden magic driven things. There was the suspension bridge in the first series and now this, and the Maker's Tower or Maker's Home, Maker's House, House of the Maker.
Yeah.
That's different.
That said, yeah, that's I think is supernatural, but
that is
the other
a different
two,
thing.
The suspension bridge. Yeah.
But it is very interesting from a world building standpoint to have large leaps in civil engineering and military engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Come all at once.
Yeah. I mean, one could argue the Gurkish fire before this, right? Like that was one of the presentations. And interestingly enough, PJ, this is also a payoff to a beat in, I think it's The Last Argument of Kings, wherein Sarrazin is trying to present his research with different powders or one of the adepti chemical. I think it's Sarrazin is presenting research for like money and is like, oh no, come check out. We're working on these powders to Glockta. And this is something that Baez was working
on. Glockta's looking at how could Baez have blown up that wall?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Right. Right. Yeah. The wall in the room way long ago. Yeah. Sorry. I was trying to track. I was like, which one?
Sorry.
Oh yeah. But he's looking into magic and demons and other things like that is sort of the supernatural side of things, even though it was the supernatural, of course, but in reality, it was still Baez was doing this research in the background to get us here. So
it's Baez all the way down.
Baez all the way down. So from there, we return to Gorst and he reflects on the failure of war in many ways, or of this little experiment, to say the least. It makes for an incredible juxtaposition, especially between the comparison of Baez and Gorst and sort of their, you know, desires for the world to some degree, as Baez had reflected on the cost of progress in war earlier, you know, in sort of the price and like the time that it was consuming and how it was going on too long and everything else, and the capability that may come with being able to wage it more effectively, you know, without rain, which he talks about over the course of this chapter a couple of different times. But meanwhile, Gorst wishes, the warrior Gorst, of whom we know as this fearsome swordman, wishes for the real lives of humanity to be furthered through hospitals, almhouses, and even just burials for the poor. Like he has truly altruistic desires inside of his heart.
Yes and no. I think so. But I think it's so far down that it doesn't come out as desire. It comes out as fleeting questions of what could have been purchased in those estimations versus these giant chunks of metal. Because it doesn't. Yes, I think you're right, but it's so far buried that it does. Like that's not how it's.
Yeah,
presented.
It's coded in reality. I understand. Yeah. Like there's a coding of reality. Gorst is far more utilitarian, you know. Yeah, than that, but he still like has that like dream, you know, for reality. Like there's notes of good in Gorst versus like there are plenty of other characters of whom would never think similar things at all that we're reading in perspective of right now.
I think the only reason why I'm pushing against this so much, if you can call this pushing against this, it feels very similar to him seeing the mother and the two children getting kicked out of their home and remarking that he could very easily provide them a safe, warm place to stay with his tent, and just doesn't, puts it out of his brain, walks away. That's that. So like he recognizes when something good could be done and could be done by him or could be done by the resources that are going into this war, but he doesn't seem to actually wish for that to be different so much that he'll actually take action on it.
Well, yeah, he doesn't have the ability, station or otherwise. He is way too selfish and egotistical because all he really wants is to be back in the king's favor to even try to push for those things, because that would be pushing against that goal likely. Mm-hmm. But is that the right thing to do? You know, I don't know. He's got that conflict in him, which is nice.
Yeah.
It's a good touch of character.
It is.
He sees what good could be, but understands why it can't be, or why it won't be, perhaps. Yeah. As it goes, though, Sulphur departs to maybe head off some Cantic interference, and the Adepti with Sarrazin find themselves in a tricky spot, describing each of the various cannons as unusable going forward. Gorst picks up a Sunburst shield, Shield of the Union, and heads towards the old bridge to fight the old-fashioned way as this hero, as you'd said before, while Baez tries to settle on a name for the new contraptions.
I really think he should have gone with fire engines. That was such a good joke.
There's so many good meta jokes. What was the primary one? Death tubes? Oh, God. So bad. Painfully bad. Which is like a perfect bit. All right, cool. With that, we get into reasoned debate. We return to Beck, watching the conflict outside, the death inflicted in all directions. This is sort of our middle chapter of our Finry and Beck chapters. Death inflicted in all directions. I think it is safe to say that the battle isn't half what he thought it would be on the whole. He turns to Reft to suggest they run, but Reft is unloading arrows outside in the open window, shooting all that he can. Reft turns and heads downstairs, ready to fight the men who have made it into the building after Stotter shouts for help from the downstairs. And Beck is frozen in fear entirely, unable to draw the bow, unable to shoot arrows, unable to follow his friend, in quotes.
Nah.
You know?
He's not scared. He's not frozen. He's just securing the upstairs. Everyone knows the most important thing to do is to secure the heart of the stronghold.
The upstairs cupboard. Which is what he does.
Exactly. And he does it expertly. Yeah. No, it's Beck. Poor Beck. Poor little boy Beck.
Mm-hmm. So this battle panic continues as the sounds overwhelm him and he thinks of his mother, what he wants. He hears everything downstairs and he finds that he'd pissed himself. He draws his father's sword, ready to maybe do what needs to be done, but gets caught in a daydream of home. He stares down the stairs at the scene and sees two of Flood's men down, bleeding out, and his friends being run down by the Union force. He turns back and heads into a cupboard, pulling out one of the shelves, and as Joe describes it, like a child's bad hiding place. And that also means that he knows that it's a bad hiding place. Like, he's fully aware of what he's doing here.
But what the fuck else is he going to do?
Yeah.
You know, it's a good reminder, I think, that we are dealing with literal children.
He's 18?
17?
Beck's 18? 17? Maybe?
And 17. Is, like, put in charge of these kids because he's, like, the oldest and most experienced as a child without any experience.
Right. Yeah. Fair. Yeah. I mean, fair point.
I mean, yes, he's 18, whatever. Like,
he's 17. You're right. Mid 17.
That daydream in the middle of all this was so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
The commentary on like what he's done with his, like what he used to do with his father's sword at night. Like pulling it out and like play fighting with it and being ready for this. And it's all shit.
It's Beck is such a good commentary on the farm boy trope. Mm-hmm. Such a good commentary on the like fantasy farm boy, right? Like Beck, by all accounts, is Luke Skywalker, except for this is how Luke Skywalker really should have fucking been, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Tough. Especially with a legendary warrior father, you know, like all that in the background, too. So from there, from that sad moment in the cupboard, we find ourselves back in Finry's perspective, sitting pretty in Meade's command hall. But something is amiss as she sees a Northman out the window. She addresses a captain of whom we come to identify as Hardrick, quickly telling him that he has to ride to Jalenhorm to let him know what's happening or for Croy to get it out.
She, on the other hand, of our inexperienced people, like she is the total flip side. Of I'm suddenly in this incredibly dangerous, no good, very bad situation. And she has some slip ups and she gets gripped by fear a little bit, but she takes action. She genuinely takes the reins as much as she's able to and helps, you know. She puts them in a much better situation than they would have been had she done nothing.
She has a bias for action, which is great. She also, to your point, is the most competent of our point of views for the most part, outside of maybe Craw, but pretty much the most competent, you know, strategist probably on the whole of our point of views right there with Calder, but the least respected by comparison, you know, for her position simply as a woman, perhaps even worse off actually being the daughter of Croy in Meade's situation, where it's like, do you really expect me just to trust you and whatever else because of that? So it's tough. Like, it's tough for her. I grow to like Finry a lot over these three chapters, personally.
Yeah. I think she's growing on me too. Even
though she kind of lashes out. Yeah. Yeah. She's got a lot of complexity. They quickly batten down the hatches, though, as the Northmen come charging in, and they're found surely without anyone here to help them hold. No archers, no one but the immediate staff left. And this is all because of Meade's sort of like, we'll send them all, you know, to the city to take it, and we won't need anyone behind, versus Finry's own advice of like, well, maybe you keep a third, you know, back, as Croy said. It's probably the smart move, and we get caught with our pants down here because of his inexperience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And looks like Finry, you know, looks for help, you know, and Meade is also desperately reaching and asking, begging for help.
Yeah, he's asking Finry, what do we do?
Yeah.
And she doesn't know. But I think that's a very important turn to note, that like when push comes to shove, Meade's the one looking for direction and looking to Finry for direction. So I think it's probably more likely that he would have been looking to anybody for direction here, but maybe it's a note that he does believe in her strategical prowess.
Yeah, is the strategic prowess. It is interesting that he at the very least has.
You don't like my word strategical?
Strategical prowess. No, it's fine. I just wanted to use the past perfect. That was my preference. But
you wanted to use the right word. You can say it.
Yes. Yeah, it's like when this is coming up in the next chapter, but when Foss Deep and Shallow are talking and he's like, you don't like my parts of speech. It's like, what a comparison. Yeah, man.
Yeah. So
what a horrible cliffhanger to leave on.
Yeah, what?
Oh, man.
What's going to happen to Finry?
We know, but we don't have time to record. We don't have time to record the rest of the episode this week for a number of different reasons. It's super okay, but we're going to leave this here. We're going to attach Chains of Command, of which I'm very excited to talk about, closing remarks, and Straight Edge to the next week. Everything's already done. Next week is like a little bit of a shorter week, even though there's like 9 chapters in quotes, because they're all like pretty short, quick chapters for the most part. So totally fine. And we'll do that then. So for next week, what we'll be reading is the entirety of the rest of day 2, which is basically what we'll be covering is Chains of Command through Chain of Command through My Land. So again, Chains of Command through My Land.
If you'd like the in the intervening week to meet up with us on social media, you can do so at Words Whiskey Pod or Words and Whiskey Pod. What? It's always been Words Whiskey Pod. I'm just reading this right now.
Except for our Reddit handle is Words and Whiskey Pod.
Ah, okay. That's, yeah.
Yeah, so our Reddit handle is the only thing that's different from everything else.
Okay.
Which is worse.
Yeah, well, you can avoid all of this. You can sidestep that problem by reaching out to us directly by cellular telephone at 910-408-2534.
And we want again thank everyone for kind of getting the reviews on Spotify. We're up over 100 reviews. I think I said this last week, but thank you again. We also have a new patron. Thank you, Chris Irwin, for hopping on the patron train. Very excited to have you at the bartender tier. So absolutely amped there. If you want to support us, patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. We've got this new mini series we're going to be working on with Pantheon once we get ahead of the heroes. But I have notes and thoughts, and I've rewatched a whole season at this point because I've seen episode one.
It's really good. Woo.
Yeah. But very excited to continue down that train. Beyond that, if you want to leave us a review, please do. Otherwise, we're gonna lock you up in a little cupboard, I guess.
We're gonna make you piss your pants.
That'll be exactly what we do. All right, cool. Well, with that, we will see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.